This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on September the 29th, 2000. Our speaker is Mary F. of San Jose, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mary, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
I was hoping he might forget my name or something. It would humble me, but he didn't. I asked him how long I was supposed to talk, and he said 2 hours, and I got scared for a minute, but then I remembered that wouldn't happen. He told me there was a speaker here recently that only talked till 20 to 9. I said, well, I might do that. No, just kidding. Anyway, I want to welcome the newcomers, and especially the people that didn't stand up. I didn't stand up at my first meeting. And the visitors, a friend of mine's here from work and her husband, and she's not one of us, but I told her to check us out. And I think we have a real good group here. I'm really glad to be sober today and in my right mind. Before I came here, usually on Friday night, I was far from being in my right mind. But I'll go back to the beginning, like when I was born. No. Now, just to tell you a little bit about myself, I was born in New York, Rochester, New York, upstate. I was adopted at 3 months old into an Irish Catholic family, and I'm Italian, and something else too. But and I was always told I was adopted, but I always felt like there was still something wrong with it. The people that adopted me, my parents, are wonderful people, and I'm really blessed to have them. And I know now that it isn't... I know if I was to meet my real biological mother today, she would be like a stranger to me. I just want to see who I'd look like. But for anybody that's been adopted or knows what I'm talking about, that has caused an emptiness in my life, my whole life, and I drank a lot over that one. But I'm happy to report that getting sober and working the steps has really relieved some of that self-centered fear that I had. And I know that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, and there's no mistakes. I've learned that here. Things happen that might not be to my liking, but I'm not in charge. And I had a pretty normal life. My mom and dad are not alcoholics. My mom has like one drink a year. Her cheeks turn red. She says, I feel funny. And she doesn't have a drink until next Christmas, you know. My dad, he has a couple beers after he plays golf. And he also has that narcolepsy, you know, that sleeping disease. So, you know, you add a couple beers to that, which makes you sleepy anyway. And you'll be talking to him, and he just goes, Dad. And he's asleep. You go, Dad, wake up. I had a pretty normal upbringing. I didn't see Dad beat Mom. I never saw anybody drunk, and I was always loved and encouraged, and, you know, I have no complaints about my upbringing. I can't blame my alcoholism on my parents or anybody else. Nobody ever held me down and poured booze down my throat. Nobody held me down and stuck a needle in my arm. I did it all myself. But what I know is growing up, and I don't know, you know, I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, and I don't spend a lot of time thinking about why I'm an alcoholic. That's just the way it is for me. And what I can tell you is I'm happy to know I'm an alcoholic now, because for the first 34 years of my life, I didn't know what I was. I just knew that there was something real different about me, and I felt like nobody understood and there was no one else like me. A lot of the things I tell you tonight are going to be things that I've learned and discovered since I've been sober. And all I know is I basically existed, and drugs and alcohol kept me alive long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, people say that alcoholics don't have any willpower, and I beg to differ on that. I think we have a hell of a lot of willpower, because we did whatever we had to do to get wherever we had to be to get whatever we needed to do, and then we got here. And I think it takes a hell of a lot of willpower to stay here, too. In fact, I think it takes a whole lot of guts and everything you got to stay here. So my drinking started about, I think I was about 14 years old, drinking, smoking pot. I don't remember my first drunk. It doesn't really matter to me. But I know that I love the effect, and I chase that effect for the next, 20 years. I ended up going to an all-private girls' Catholic high school. I was raised Catholic. I don't do Catholic bashing anymore. I don't need to, but what I do know is I was in like a separate little world. I really wanted to go to public school, and I'm grateful now that my parents could afford to send me to a private school in hopes that I would get an education. And, I found out, especially in high school, that some of those girls in that Catholic school were way worse than probably some of the ones at public school. And I found out exactly who they were, and I started hanging out with them. And, there was kind of two kinds of girls at my high school. There were the ones that got sent there, and they were in trouble. And then there was just the little rich bitches, And I didn't like them. I just liked the girls that had been in trouble. And I really hadn't gotten in any trouble, but I just kind of gravitated toward the bad girls. And one thing I want to say is, my mom always used to tell me what a good girl I was, And I used to think, why did she tell me that? Maybe I'm really bad and she's just telling that to make me feel better, I used to think there was a secret around me, like maybe I was my cousin's daughter or, I didn't know where I came from. I always looked around in the family when we had family reunions to see if I looked like anybody. I have a adopted brother, too, who's 8 years older than me, and he's 9 years older than me. And when I was 9 years old, he went into the military, and after that, I only saw him on leave, and I felt very abandoned by him. Now, one thing I do have to share is that right after my brother got out of the military, we were out having dinner, and everyone used to ask me if I was Italian. I'd say, oh, no, I'm Irish, and my mom used to just tell me I was Irish, And I said, Mom, come on, tell me. Everybody asks me if I'm Italian. They say, I looked Italian, but you tell me I'm Irish. And she said, well, how we read you and your brother that book saying how special you were. And she goes, well, I grew up in New York where there was segregated neighborhoods at this time. There was the Jewish neighborhood and the Italians. And my mom said, well, you really are half Italian, and you've got some Irish and Swedish and Indian in you. And I didn't want you to be called names. And I remember getting really pissed off. I think I was about, I was about 10. I got really pissed off because I thought, wait a minute, you've always read this book to me telling me that it's good to be adopted and how special I was, and now the truth comes out that it's not okay to be what I am, So I got confused, and I got pissed off. And I carried that one with me for a long time, too. In high school, I did the regular high school thing. I drank. I used to tell Mom I was going to the football games, and I'd end up in the orchard all night drinking, smoking dope. I'd get home, and we had these, as soon as you open our front door, we had these tiles, like a foyer, and then it went right into the living room, and that's where my dad's chair was. Oh, God. I used to come in the front door sometimes and fall right on the tile. And my house was like one of those houses where, like, there's a pink elephant in the living room, and everybody knows it's there, but everybody walks around it, steps over it. Nobody talks about it. We didn't talk about anything. And the only thing my dad would say when I came in like that and got myself up off the floor is he'd get up, and he'd say, do you know what time it is? And I'd say, no. And he'd say, we'll talk about this in the morning, young lady. And I'd go, okay. And I'd go down the hall holding the walls and pass out. And we never did talk about it in the morning. I started to not come home, especially during the summers and stuff, and I started to get pretty defiant toward my folks, and my mom would ask me how school was, and I'd just yell at her and say, what do you care? I wasn't nice. My mom worked at a junior high and used to take these little drug classes to help her identify, with the students, And one night I was sitting up, and my girlfriend and I, it was a Friday night, we got home late, and we took that day off school or something, I don't remember, but we had some reds and some acid, and she took the reds at the beach, and I took the acid, right? And I took it late in the afternoon, and that night, of course, I still couldn't sleep, and I was, like, still peeking, and it was, like, really good window pane I put in my eye, and And I'm sitting in the living room, and my mom had this vase of chrysanthemums, really big white ones. And I remember they were going like this at me. Woo. And my mom's going, "Mary, what's wrong with you?" And I said, "Oh, you know," and I'm thinking about my mom tells me about this stuff at the junior high. So I said, "Well, Mom, you know that stuff that truck drivers take to keep awake, you know, that stuff, speed?" And she goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, I was at this party, and I said, I think somebody put something in my drink, you know." And she got all paranoid, and I kept telling her, "Don't tell Dad." And, you know, my mom sat up with me all night while I was tripping on acid. Pretty funny. I have a lot of stories to tell you, boy, you know, about the nuns. You know, my first time I dropped acid was in high school, and I had to go to art class. Ooh. That was pretty cool. But, you know, this girl dared me at school. She said, "This is orange sunshine," and it looked like vitamin C. And I said, "Ah, no, it isn't." And I said, "Give me that." And I just took the whole thing, you know. And, you know, I would take anything at any time if you told me I'd get off on it. And I even took things that you wouldn't tell me I'd get off of it just to see if I would. You know, I come from the days when they had, you know, jars of whites for $100, you know, and they were good. And, I remember doing stupid shit like taking contacts and dumping the insides out, and then, you know, when I was tweaking, taking all the little time release things out and putting those in a pile, and then I'd snort the white stuff, and then I'd eat the time. I did really weird shit. One time we did mushrooms, and someone told me, "Oh, you got to try these." So we cooked them and we boiled them in water, and then we poured a bunch of sugar in it. And my friend said, "You got to drink the water and then eat the mushrooms." I said, "Okay," and they tasted like dirt. It was really bad. And I don't know how long I was in the backyard, but I do remember sitting against the fence in their backyard, and they hadn't mowed their lawn in years, and the grass was like going like this, and I just remember just going like this with the grass. And my friend's husband invited the neighbor over and wanted us to make hors d'oeuvres, and we were, like, so high. And just, I remember things like that, but I don't remember long segments. I remember little short things. And, you know, I did learn at an early age when I was drinking. I can't tell you when, but I know that something bad was happening. And what was happening is when I just drank alcohol, I started noticing, like, I would be here and then I would be there. And I didn't know what had happened in between that time. And I since learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that's called a blackout. I would lose time. My friends would tell me I did really stupid things when I drank. And, you know, I just decided I didn't like them and found somebody else to party with. I knew nothing about alcoholism. I did begin to notice that I drank very fast. I drank a lot. And I was very selfish with my alcohol. If we got somebody to buy us a bottle, I would announce to my friends that this is my bottle. Get your own. I will not share. Don't ask me. You know, I had my standard announcement. you know, I began to get ostracized from my friends in high school. And so I did the next best thing. I had met some friends that weren't in high school, and I ended up starting to party with these guys from Moffett Field. Now, they knew how to party, those Navy guys. And, you know, I did whatever I needed to do what I wanted to do. And needless to say, I just moved up into my level of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I know now what I did. And what I did on a most regular basis was compromise my morals, values, and principles. You know, and I didn't think about it too much except for little glimpses of, wow, this isn't right, or coming to wherever I came to and thinking, you know, who is this person, or where am I, or, you know, waking up with blood on my clothes, or, you know, just bad. You know, I saw a lot of violence, too. I don't even want to really talk about that, but a lot of bad stuff happened when I drank, and I'm not telling you that every time I drank, bad stuff happened, but every time real bad stuff happened, I had been drinking. And so I did start using drugs, and drugs are part of my story, and I used a lot of speed to enhance my drinking, and it basically, I didn't black out as often. I was able to drink a lot more, and, you know, I know that I'm an alcoholic, and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes to me that if I try to suddenly stop or I have little control over the amount I take, I'm probably an alcoholic. And I share that with you because that was the first thing that I heard that got my attention that maybe I was an alcoholic. But I'm jumping ahead. Let's see. I got out of high school. I immediately moved out with some people that I had met at the beach. Yeah. I grew up in the 60s and 70s generation, so it was like love the one you're with, you know, and I did. And but, you know, it wasn't all bad, you know, it wasn't all bad. I used to go to Winterland in the Fillmore. I wish I could remember, but I don't. I remember I went to the fairgrounds and I saw Janis Joplin, but I can't remember the concert, but I know I was there. You know, stuff like that. I missed a lot. You know, and I was still, by the time I was 18, 19 years old, I was pretty much still in the fun stage. I never did get arrested. I never really did get in trouble. By then, I was really pissing my family off. We're from the East Coast, of course. We're out here, so when relatives came and I didn't show up with a car, or, you know, my uncle would lose, or my aunt and uncle would miss their plane flight, you know, stuff like that would happen. I'd get bitched at, and it's like, whatever. But one thing I did do that is very memorable to me that I'm not proud of to this day is that my mom was bitching at me one time, and she put her hand up to me, and my parents never hit me. And she said something, and I said, "What do you care? You're not even my real mother." And I hurt that woman bad. And I said, "If you hit me, bitch, I'll knock you out." You know. And I said that to my mom, and it still kills me to this day that I would talk to my mother that way. And that woman has just suffered magnificently over me. And, you know, she put her hands up in disgust, and she said, I know I'm powerless over you, and I'll pray for you. And I'm grateful to say, and I remind her all the time today, that I'm glad she didn't give up on me. When I was 19 years old, I married this drunk guy that I met at the beach to get out of the house. See, that's what I did. I really didn't make good decisions when I was drinking. I got pregnant. I quit smoking. And when I was 5 months pregnant, I lost a baby. And I was 19 years old, and they put me in a hospital room with a lady who had just had a baby. I don't know why. And they gave me some drugs to, like, I guess put me to sleep, and they told me, don't get up. And in the middle of the night, I woke up with contractions, and I lost my son in the toilet at 19 years old. And I don't share that stuff for you to feel sorry for me, but, you know, to tell you that I know now that I was scared, I was confused, I was into the depths of my alcoholism and drug addiction, and I did the next best thing. The day I got out of the hospital the next day, and I started shooting heroin, and that took the pain away. And I did that for about a year and a half, and I came down with hepatitis really bad. I was living at home again. My marriage had dissolved with that guy. And I started turning yellow and losing weight, and my running partner, my new one, I just couldn't get off the couch anymore. And my mom finally took me to the doctor, and you know, that he suggested that I go see a shrink, and, you know, tried to talk to me about what was wrong with me. And, you know, my denial was so deep then, I just said, you can't tell my mom anything, because this is doctor-patient confidentiality. And I saw my first shrink at 19 years old, and he was an ass. And, you know, what he said, and I ended up seeing a lot of shrinks for the next, I don't know, until I was 34 years old. And, you know, I was getting ready to turn 21, and my doctor said, you know, you really shouldn't drink anymore because you didn't do too good of a job on your liver. And I said, well, people drink when they turn 21, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I went bar hopping with a friend, and some of you people that are a little older will remember St. James Infirmary in Mountain View. That was one of the bars I partied in, and I liked it so much I went back there the next day and got a job there. And some of you know Dolores that comes to this group. I met her there that next day, and she has the same birthday as me, only she's a year older, and I've been partying with her ever since. And And we partied really hard there. I hung out with this group of people called the family. No relation to the Charles Manson family, but we partied quite a bit. We had a party for anything. And, you know, even then, my friends were dying from the disease of alcoholism. One run they went up to Coyote, and I didn't go to that one that time, and my friend drove off a cliff and died, and you know, it didn't even faze me. We just went, oh, poor Billy, you know, and went on with it. I made like really mini geographics in my disease. I'd move like from Sunnyvale to Mountain View, you know, from San Jose to Palo Alto, you know, just here and there. I still hung around in the valley, and I knew a lot of people. And one thing I know now is like when I would do things that were incredibly embarrassing or pretty tragic, for a period of time I was running around with a outlaw motorcycle group, and that was interesting. Some real bad stuff happened there, and I saw some real bad stuff happen, and I had to get away. It was like I was always worried that people were going to find me out, like they were after me, you know, acute paranoia, you know, always looking behind your shoulder, always peeking out the blinds, never feeling comfortable in your own skin. I also forgot to tell you that I had a lot of jobs. I know by the time I was 23, I'd had over 26 jobs. My shortest job was one day. I went to work my first day, and then the next day I decided to go to the beach and drop acid, and my boss was there, so I got fired. So about, when was it? About 1978, I was, where was I then? Back in Sunnyvale, and my roommate, she was bartending at a little bar in Sunnyvale called the Hofbrau, and I started working there too, and it was a swell place, you know, where there was, you know, the regular people that came in every day and sat on the same bar stool all day long and, you know, played those sad country songs and the crying in your beer, I lost my wife, I lost my dog songs, you know. And I just was in my element, you know. And it's there that I met my second husband. A lot of you guys know him, Mark. And I knew the first day I met him and I drank with him, I fell right into sick with him. And I knew I was going to marry him. And we got married and just got sicker and sicker together. And you know, I don't really want to tell you a lot of war stories because, you know, our disease is so common and our stories all get us one thing, and that's a lot of pain, a lot of pain. I was getting into the problem stage by then. When I drank alcohol, I would get beat up. I've been raped twice. I've been held at knife point. But I wasn't the angel either, because when I drank, you know, I could be happy, I could be sad, I could be mad, and you know, by this time I was pretty angry at my life and my circumstances, and you know, I pulled knives on people, guns on people, tried to run people over with my car. And I'm not really nice sometimes when I drink either, you know, I'm unpredictable. And you know what alcoholism really means for me is that when I take a drink, I don't know what's going to happen. When I take a drink, I don't know what I'm going to drink, where I'm going to go, who I'm going to be with, if I'm going to hurt anybody. But all I know is nobody's going to like it, especially me. And I got to tell you this, if I could still drink successfully today, I would, because I like to drink. You know, I'm not going to lie to you. I like to drink and I like to party. But what happened is I believe I've lost the privilege. And I'm grateful that I became aware that I lost the privilege. And I want to bring this whole story up to December of 1988. Still drinking, still using, still married. Different jobs. I started at a computer company here in the valley, and you know, I was trying to be this professional with a briefcase, and I would come home and my house was insanity, and there was drunk and drugs, and at the end of my drinking and using, I had vodka hidden in Tupperware containers in my garage because I was hiding it from my husband, who had just started drinking after not drinking for 7 years, and he was a very violent drunk, and so I was trying to hide it from him. I was freebasing cocaine every day, every night. I was snorting dope all day. I was addicted to two prescription drugs for years. I had a stash of probably over 500, 700 pills because, well, this part I forgot to tell you. 3 years prior to me getting sober, in 1985. I was really skinny then, and my liver, I was like all swollen up, and I had gone to the doctor, and they ran some tests, and the first thing the doctor said, and you know, back then they didn't have the sophisticated tests that they have today, and he said to me, "You might be dying of a fatal liver disease," and I went, "Oh, wow," and he said, "I'm going to take some more tests, but whatever you're doing, you better quit doing it," and I was like, "Yeah," so I went home, and I remember telling my husband and our friend, and we all boo-hooed for a minute, and then we did a line, and then, you know, and then I thought, well, I better, like, chill out, you know, and not drink, and I didn't drink or use for a week, and then I found out I wasn't dying, and I believe at the time, and they're still not sure if I have hepatitis C or not. First they said I had it, then they said I didn't. Now more tests are saying I might have it. They're sending me to a specialist. They said it's real weird. I show that I've been exposed to Hep C, but I have antibodies, and that's very unusual, they said. So, you know, I'm still suffering the repercussions of my drinking and using. But I was sick, and they said again to me in 1985, you better quit doing what you're doing. And it's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, during this time, I had attended a few Al-Anon meetings over at St. Luke's, and some of you know about St. Luke's, and there's an Al-Anon meeting downstairs in the basement on Tuesday night, and there's an AA meeting upstairs, and I used to go there drunk, and they would tell me, you know, maybe you should go upstairs to the AA meeting. And I'd say, oh, no, you know, someday I'll check out where Mark needs to go, but, you know, I like this meeting. And they were really nice people. They were very nice to me. And, you know, none of them ever told me you really need to go to AA. They just would gently suggest it to me. And, you know, I went to St. Luke's last Tuesday night. I haven't been there for a few years, and every time I go there, I just get like these pricklies, you know, because that was back in the 70s when I was doing that. And, you know, so here it is, December of 1988, and my sister-in-law was working at the same company that I was, and she was in HR, and she told me that this alcoholic was coming into the HR department to talk to them about drug and alcohol abuse. You know, because most companies now, if you have a problem, they encourage you to get help. They'll send you to, you know, detox companies. Employers want you to get better. And, you know, my sister-in-law said, you know, I'm going to go to the seminar. It'll be 2 days, and I'll talk to you after 2 days. And the first day she called me, and she said, "Mary, I'm really scared." And I said, "Why?" She goes, "I'm checking into Montevilla, which was a detox." And she said, "Because my hands are numb, and I haven't told anybody." And she said, "What they told me is when your hands are numb and you take a lot of prescription drugs, you know, that's a sign that you have a problem." And my sister-in-law to this day is still a legal drug addict. And, you know, we went to see her in December. It was December 21st, family night. And I'll never forget, we went into this room, and these people were talking, and then after, they had like the family, you know, visit room, and there was this thing on the wall, and it had the acceptance prayer from page 449 in the big book, and I didn't even know anything about AA. And I said to her, "Maddie, what is this big book shit?" You know, at the bottom it said big book, page 449. She goes, "Oh, that's from those stupid AA meetings they make us go to, and NA and this and that." And I just thought that was kind of weird what I read. And the nurse that night had handed us a bag with all her pills in it. And I don't know why they gave it to us. They said something about she might need them later. And I thought, wait, this doesn't make sense. She's in here to detox, and then they're giving us all her drugs, you know. Thought that was weird. But what was even weirder is exactly 1 week later, to that day, I landed in my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And not by my own virtue, by any means. This night I came, it was the last day I drank and used, and that day it didn't work. Nothing worked. I snorted dope, I took pills, I smoked pot, I drank, and nothing happened to me, and it scared me. I had never had that experience. And I got home, and my husband and the neighbor were in the front room, way drunk, and here I'm trying to do this work for my new job, and I'm going, this is not working. And I did what I always do. I'm a runner. And I threw some clothes in a bag, and I snuck out the back door, and I went to my sister-in-law's. And she said immediately, "Here, take this." And I did. I don't ever ask what it is. And nothing happened still. And my very next thought was, you know, maybe I should just kill myself. And, you know, I was never one of those people that slit my wrists or tried to overdose. Never, never, ever. And I thought that was kind of strange that I thought about killing myself. So then I thought, you know, I'm a reasonable person. I thought, well, I'll just call the suicide crisis line and see what they say about this. And I called them and told them all about him, of course, and they said, well, you should go to Al-Anon. I said, well, I tried that already. And they said, well, you should go again. So I found a meeting, and I guess I called, I guess that's how I found it, at Campbell Community Center. And some guy just came up and started walking with me. And I don't know where he came from. And I started telling him all about him, and he turned me around the opposite way and brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to think that God put that man in my life, because he just knew it was time for me, and that was the way I was going to get here. And when he brought me to the back door of room 47, you know, the door was closed, it was cold, it was December, and, you know, he knew, and he knocked on the door. The guy opened the door, and he said, oh, what kind of meeting is this? And the guy says, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, fuck you, I ain't going in there. And I cursed the guy out, and he said, well, why don't you just come in for coffee? And you know what? I did. And the miracle of the day, and that still blows me away to this day, is that I've been sober from that day to this. Now, I didn't just get sober and stay sober and everything worked out. I came in the room, and I'd never been in an AA meeting, and I didn't know really what they did in AA. I didn't know if they helped you learn how to drink correctly or socially, or if you got to drink on weekends, or I really didn't know. All I know is that there was a spirit in the room that completely just blew my mind. It wasn't a look from one person, and it wasn't a touch, and it wasn't a gesture. It was an aura. And it was in the whole room, and it just washed all over me. And I can't tell you what I heard at my first meeting, and I didn't stand up and say, Mary, I'm Mary, an alcoholic, and I need help. No. I sat in the very back corner of the room. Somebody moved their foot and let me sit on a chair. And I listened. And what really interested me is I saw a man in that meeting that I had worked at the Cardinal, or it used to be the Red Coach, years before Graveyard, and that was just my place. I bought my drugs and drank, and I saw this old guy at this first AA meeting that we used to take bet on whether he'd pass out on the bar in the bar or, you know, in the restaurant, you know, and I was kind of surprised to see Richard there. And I said, Richard, what are you doing here? And he says, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, yeah, you are, you know. So I was kind of excited about the whole deal, and I couldn't wait to come back the next day. So I came back the next day, and then my first meeting was December 28th of 1988, and that's my sobriety date. And I came back. I remember I went to my first sober New Year's Eve party that this group puts on. And if you've never experienced one, I encourage you to do so. Even if you don't decide to stay, you're welcome to come. Again, that spirit and that aura that I felt that night in that room is something I can't even describe. It's something that you got to experience yourself. And I began, you know, I don't know when and how, but I just began to feel like listening to these stories that these people understood me. You know, these people, some of them talked about some of the stuff I did. Now, I got really embarrassed when guys got, like, all emotional and shit and teary-eyed. I'd think, oh, God, you know. I was embarrassed for them because I wasn't of the school that you show your emotions anymore. I had long passed the part of sharing and caring. I was more like, I'm going to fuck you over before you get me. You know, and that's just how I came here. You know, and what I know now is I was a scared little girl that was so tired of being hurt by life and by you that I would fight you, I would cause shit, and I was angry. I was so angry when I came here. And it's okay. It doesn't matter how you get here. And so I kept coming back to meetings, and I remember I was still staying at my sister-in-law's, and I remember calling Mark and telling him that, you know, I found this place, and I want you to go with me because maybe they can help us, you know. And he reminds me of that to this day, you know, and he came with me to meetings, and he didn't want to go when he came with me sober, and then the next night he might call me from the meeting, and he was shit-faced drunk, but he would be here. And I still remind him to this day, he got sober a month later, that I'm senior sobriety here, and respect your elders, no. But he got it, and that was an amazing thing, too. And, you know, we began both to work our programs, and we got sponsors, and we got into our sobriety, and we got into service, and we did the things that people suggested for us to do. And, you know, if I had heard, you're not going to get it unless you exactly do this, I might, maybe I wouldn't stay, but people were so loving to me, and I really didn't like God when I got here. That's the other thing. When I lost that baby, that was it, when I was 19 years old. That was it. I was done with God. I decided at a very early age, probably around there, that God did not love me, that because I was a bastard child, because that's what I called myself, that I was never going to be happy. I was never going to have love. You know, that the American dream of the white picket fence and the husband and wife and 2.5 kids was a bunch of bullshit in my book, you know. I thought my parents were squares. I said, fuck the establishment. I mean, I was just anti-everything, angry. And you know, I had a really hard time in meetings when they talked about God. And I would stand up and announce to everyone around me that this was another goddamn God meeting. And I would try to leave. And sometimes people made me stay. Do you remember? CM knew me then. But you know what? I just kept coming back. And I kept hearing, you know, if you take these steps and take these suggestions and do these things, you never have to drink again. And that didn't impress me. In fact, I didn't stand up and introduce myself as an alcoholic when I was new. My third meeting, I said, I'm an addict, and I really even wasn't too convinced, but I thought you had to say something to stay here. And so I said that, you know, whatever. And so I just kept coming back, because that's what they told me to do. They said, just keep coming back. And, you know, I heard people talking about detoxes, and I didn't even know what a detox was, except for I remember my sister-in-law was at that hospital, and I always felt like there was bugs on me and cobwebs, and I was detoxing off all this shit, you know, and I'd tell people, I feel like there's bugs on me and bugs all around me, and sometimes there really were, but most of the time there wasn't, and I was just, ugh. And I was really high strung. I'm still that way sometimes now, but I would go to work, and I was just like high strung all the time, and I'd tell them, I have to go to an AA meeting, and they'd say, good, you know, go. And I'd go, and sometimes I'd come to a noon meeting, and I'd go out with people for lunch, and I'd call work, and I'd say, I'm not coming back. And they'd say, that's okay, you know, and God bless that place I worked at, that they were really glad I was getting sober. And at about 3 months sober, I remember hearing Mike D. A lot of you know Mike D. And I don't know when this tragedy happened in his life, but I heard him talking about his daughter leaving his house one night with her boyfriend and then getting a call a few hours later that she was dead and he didn't drink. And I sat up in my chair. I wanted to know how do you do that, because I thought just about losing a child, and that got my attention. And I heard you never have to hurt the way you've been hurting ever again if you don't want to. And that got my attention, because I was dying. I was dying so bad on the inside, and I tried real hard to look good on the outside, but, you know, death was near for my soul. Maybe I was dead, I don't know. But I just kept coming back, and at 3 months sober, I had met a girl in these rooms, and I knew that I knew her from somewhere, and it turned out I had a job one day at this place, actually 2 days, that I quit at, and she was there at training, and I ended up asking her to be my sponsor. And she said a very simple question. She said, are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? And I said, I guess, you know, whatever. And you know, sometimes you hear people talking about, if you're willing to push a peanut down, where they used to say Campbell Avenue, with your nose naked. I said, what kind of shit is that, you know? That's stupid, you know? But I wanted to take the steps by then, because I was coming too, and I was hearing success stories, and I was hearing people talking about not only the pain and the heartache and that ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic, I was starting to hear about joy and recovery and peace and serenity, and I wanted that. So I took a chance. I figured, what have I got to lose? I only have what I have, which isn't, I didn't want what I had. And so I took the steps. I made a commitment to take the steps. And I began the steps, and it was March of 1989. And I still have that first 12 and 12, where I wrote down who I first worked the steps with in 1989, and I made little notes. And my first 2 or 3 years of sobriety, I used to bring my little day timer. You know, girls carry those in their purse. And I used to write down things I heard in meetings, because I couldn't remember anything. I used to go to John Romelli's house for a big book study meeting every Wednesday night. He still has that meeting today. And they used to play the big book on tape. You can buy the big book on tape and the 12 and 12 on tape if you have a hard time reading, and you can listen to it. And, you know, I took speed reading in high school. I can read a trashy novel in an hour if I want to, but comprehend anything good for me, not. So I would go there, I would sit there with my book, I would listen to the tape, and I would cry because I couldn't remember anything. And, you know, people told me, don't worry, it takes time. You know, it takes time for your brain cells to come back. And what happened is my sponsor insisted that I go to one big book study meeting a week, one 12 and 12 study meeting a week, a woman's meeting, and then whatever else I wanted to do. And she also suggested that I sit in the first five rows of the meeting because that way I would hear and not be paying attention to everybody screwing around in the back of the room. So I did. My sponsor used to drag me up to newcomers after the meeting and tell me, shake her hand, get her phone number. She insisted that I get a phone number of a newcomer and an old-timer at every meeting I went to. And, you know, I did these things, but I wasn't really happy about it. And I did it anyway because I didn't want to hurt the way I'd been hurting ever again. And I kept holding on to the promise that maybe if I did these things, this thing they talked about, a spiritual awakening or a psychic change, might happen for me, you know. So I did these things. And my first sponsor, she told me stupid things like, take a bubble bath. What? Now, I'm a speed freak, okay? I am not a relaxing kind of person here. And she'd say, run a nice bath and put bubbles in it and all this girly stuff, which I wasn't too interested in. And so I'd do it, and I'd get in. I'd sit there for a minute. I'd get out. I'd go call her. Said, I took a bubble bath. You know, that was it. She took me to get my nails done for the first time. That might not mean anything to you guys, but it means something to me because I never ever did anything nice for myself like that. She used to put makeup on me and show me things about my clothes. And you know, I'm not saying that I came from off the street and didn't know how to dress, but I had my way, I was set in my way, and it was only my way, and I was not open to anything. I didn't want to spend money on any extracurricular activities because it would take away from my drug use and alcohol use. So this sponsor took my work the first 8 steps in 8 weeks. And, you know, I don't really remember hearing, I know people were saying it, but they talked about balking. You know, everyone talks about balking at the 4th step. It says in the book at some of these steps we balked, you know, and we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. You know, all I know is I did what I was told. And I, to this day, I would never, ever think of disrespecting my sponsor. I'm amazed today, quite frankly. I sponsor some women that talk disrespectful to me, and I don't go for that. I believe that a sponsor is someone that gives you a very valuable gift, and that is their time. You know, if you get sober and stay sober, your life becomes full, rich, and busy, and meaningful. And I don't waste time with people that don't want to do the deal. I work with others so that I can stay sober myself. And, you know, they say things, they have a lot of little cliches here, and one of them is that you can't keep it unless you give it away. You know, and so unless I've got to give it away. Whether somebody wants it or not is none of my business, but I got to just keep trying to give it away. And I started sponsoring women when I was 6 months sober, and boy, that's when the joy really starts to come. It's another benefit of taking the steps. You know, and of course, I was insecure like most of us are that, you know, I don't have anything to offer and I don't remember anything you're teaching me and how do I do this? And that's what a sponsor is for, to call up and say, okay, what do I do now? And, you know, my sponsor guided me through taking my first sponsee through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to see the lights come on for another woman, and I got to look her in the eye and feel her pain through sharing an inventory. And I got to love her and give to her what was freely given to me, unconditional love. And I know for me, that's when my sobriety started to skyrocket because I began to realize that I was remembering things I heard in these meetings. I was beginning to remember the things I read in the book. And I began to see that my life was, and it began to be evident to me that maybe I really was meant to be here and that I wasn't just a nothing. I didn't have a lot of self-esteem about myself when I got here, and I felt just like a piece of dust that just drifted and settled here or there, and I just never felt that I was good enough. And I began to get some self-respect for myself through working with others. Another thing that my sponsor strongly encouraged for me was to get into service. And there's all kinds of service commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. Back then, you could smoke in meetings, and it was cleaning ashtrays or doing the coffee pot. And it's amazing, you know. And I, you know what, I talk about room 47 because it's where I got sober. And if you don't like it, too bad. But a lot of people cap on people about that. If you got sober in this room, right on, you can cap. You could talk about this room. But I talk about where I got sober. And, you know, back then, there was an enthusiasm in the room. When the secretary asked for people to help clean up, sometimes there was like 15 people trying to make the coffee and or do the coffee, and there was people mopping the floor and straightening the chairs, and you barely get two people at any meeting I've seen here in the last few years that do anything to help out. And, you know, I was taught that service is a way of saying thank you for my sobriety. You know, my sobriety is a gift, free and clear. You know, someone spent time to give me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and granted, I've had to do some things and be willing on my part, but you know, this program is for free. You know, we ask you that you maybe buy a book. Wow, $5. So what do you do to say thank you for your sobriety? You know, a lot of us can go to the coffee shops after the meetings and, you know, smoke cigarettes outside the room and throw them on the ground and just think that somebody else is going to clean it up. And, you know, your mother doesn't work here. You know, and that's just something I wanted to share. And you know, and what else I've learned here through the steps and through my God, and I found a God here. God, I got to tell you about that. Whew. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous tells you that you can find a God of your own understanding. That if you don't have a loving God, you could throw that God away. And that that you better find a God that works for you. And having faith in God is one thing, but having faith in a God that's personal to you is another thing. And, you know, over the years, you know, and in my early recovery, I made a list and I made a description of the God that I wanted, and that's my God. And over the years, attraction of having some dignity and self-respect in my life and joy is because of the willingness on my part to take the steps and to be in service, period. But you know what? I really believe that I'm a product of a loving God that wants to use me to carry His message. You know, our book says that my job is to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. And I believe that's to the best of my ability. My book also says that I'm not a doormat, and I don't have to crawl before anybody, and I don't. I know today that I can stand before you with dignity, and I can tell you anything about my past because it is my greatest asset today, that the things that I did that were shameful, harmful to me and others are a result of my alcoholism. And what I know today is I have a responsibility to myself and you to be the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can be. And that means being respectful to the people here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to talk a little bit about the steps. You know, that inventory that I was telling you about, I wrote that inventory. And, you know, I told my sponsor, I said, I'm really not angry at anybody. And she said, yes, you are. And when we took the third step, she said, what you do is when you get ready to write this inventory, after she explained it to me, she said, you pick up that pen and you remember that you're working for God now. God's running your life. And so you ask Him to help you write the inventory. It'll take so much pressure off you. And it's like, yeah. So I'd pick up that pen and I'd say, God, please help me write as much as I can and let me know when it's time to stop. And I did that. And when I couldn't write anymore, I would put my book away. And I remember going to my sponsor's house to share that inventory, and I was really scared because I had written down things that I was never going to tell anybody, things that I was very ashamed of. Things that I thought if I shared with this woman, she might tell me to go away. And, you know, I took a risk. And I got to her house, and I don't know how she knew, but she said this to me. She said, okay, go in my room and write down everything you didn't. And I thought, how did she know? You know, and us sponsors have that sponsor knowledge, you know, that we get. We go to sponsor school, and no, just kidding. Because, you know, we think... You know, I suffer from a disease of terminal uniqueness, too, you see, and I think my case is so different, and I'm so special, and, you know, my stuff is the worst, and at least that's how I got here. And, you know, that day, a human being named Judy and a human being named Mary shared the secrets of their soul, and what I found out was that I was just another alcoholic that was sharing my stuff with another woman alcoholic. And, you know, our book says that when we take this step, you know, a lot of remarkable things will happen. And it says that we'll begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. And I don't know if I felt that, but I can tell you this, is after I made my list of the people I had harmed that our 8-step asked us to do, I remember when I burned that inventory in that fireplace that day, that I felt like a 300-pound weight was lifted off of me. I had never felt so free. And, you know, there was still more work to do. You know, I did the 6th step and the 7th step, and what the purpose of that 4th step is for is to find the things in me that are blocking me from God. You know, we all have our crosses to bear. We all have, you know, like some people steal and some people lie and, you know, some people do what they do. But, you know, I found the things in me, my defects of character. And, you know, we have our 12 and 12 talks about a universal list. And I probably can't remember them all, the 7 deadly sins, but there's something like pride, greed, fear, anger, lust, envy, sloth. And that was like one of my big ones. Sloth means lazy, procrastinating, and jealous. That was mine. And angry and fearful. And, you know, there's a whole bunch more. There's dishonesty. And, you know, I found out that day that I had some defects of character. And as my sponsor had me write these things down, as I shared this inventory with her, and my part of all this action of what I thought, how people had wronged me so bad, I was getting real nervous because I had this sheet and one side said assets and one side said liabilities, right? And I'm writing down greedy and angry and jealous, you know. And I'd read some to her and she'd say, well, do you think you were a little dishonest there? And I go, yeah. She'd go, write that down. So I'd write that down. And, you know, that side of the paper was getting really big. And I looked at it and I said, I am fucked, man. And I looked at that and I said, oh, I'm a bad person. You know, and she goes, well, wait a minute. And, you know, she said, you know, the list of principles. You know, we talk about principles, and a lot of people just know principles before personalities, y'all sing. But there are principles contained in the steps, right? And, you know, they are like step one is honesty, and step two is hope, and step three is faith. And what she said to me is, do you think that the fact that you took the time to write this and share this with me, she said, do you think you're being honest? And I went, yeah. And she said, well, then you have the capacity to practice honesty. I said, you're right. She said, write that down. And what she did is she brought out in me, she let me know and showed me that I am quite capable of practicing spiritual principles as well as character defects, that we all have them. That's part of our humanness. And she said, my job as a recovering alcoholic was to try to practice spiritual principles instead of character defects. And I said, but that's really hard to do. And she said, well, wait a minute. That's why the steps are in order, and that's why step 6, we're going to get into your character defects. And you know, step 6, becoming entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Well, I knew that I had to do something about what was wrong with me. And, of course, being the self-respecting alcoholic I was, I thought if I said that 7-step prayer that everything was going to be fine from then on. You know, and, you know, she sent me home. I took my list with me. I looked up those words to make sure I knew what I was going to ask God to remove from me. I said that prayer, and that night my sister-in-law called me and she wanted me to do some scheming with her against my husband. We're always scheming, stealing, scheming. And I'm on the phone, okay, sure, right. You know, she wanted me to lie. We had this plan going, I don't even know what it was about. And I got off the phone and I went, I can't believe what I just did. I agreed to lie to my husband. You know, I'm scheming behind his back. And I remember calling her back, and she was at my house when this happened, and so she left. And I remember calling and leaving a message on her answering machine, and I said, Madeline, I can't do what we just talked about. I'm trying to live a new way of life, and I have a God in my life, and I'm praying and asking Him to remove this defect of character of scheming. And my sponsor told me that if I can't tell something to my husband, I shouldn't be scheming about it. You know, I should be honest with him. And, you know, I'm going on and on, right? And she called me up and she said, you are fucking crazy. I don't know what happened to you since you've been in that AA, but you are weird now. And we didn't even speak for like 6 months, you know. And that was okay. You know, you see, I was willing to go to any length to stay sober. And I just, you know, a lot of times, I know at least for me, is when somebody sobers up, my experience has been that it's really difficult for people around that are not in the program or in Al-Anon or any other 12-step program, because the alcoholic becomes unpredictable. You know, I even remember when my ex stopped drinking, you know, it was really hard to deal with him because he wasn't doing the same things he was doing drunk. And it was even more hard to try to control him at that time. So that unpredictability is an interesting thing. And you know what? I was willing. I didn't care. You know, I was told early in my sobriety that if I wanted this program to be sober for good and for all, I'd have to be willing to walk the gauntlet. And what that means for me is I'm willing, like if there's a board going right down this room and there's sobriety at the end of the room, I have to be willing to tell you, you know what, I don't care what you say. And I don't care what you think. I got to do this. I got to get down there and I got to do these things, and it's for me to save my life. And I have to take ridicule, or if I have to lose a job over it, or if I have to lose my marriage, or, you know, whatever. Our book tells us that we have to place sobriety first. You know, if we're in here doing it for the judge or our mother or our kids, you're probably not going to stay. You know, that if you're not doing it for you, it's probably not going to work. You know, and that's why it's so awesome here, because we encourage you to just keep coming back. And, you know, my prayer for you tonight is that you do it for you, that you find in your heart, if you're sitting in this meeting tonight, that there's a reason you're here, whether you think you belong here or not. And if you don't think you belong here, maybe God's just using you to carry a message to another person. But, you know, there's a reason, and I believe now firmly in my life that there's no mistakes. Well, you know, I went and said that seven-step prayer, and God didn't remove all my defects of character. And I made that list, and I began the process of making my amends. And my sponsor told me that steps 10, 11, and 12 were about growing up in this program. They weren't about maintaining my sobriety. Why would I want to maintain what I have? I got to continue to grow. And, you know, she told me to take that inventory at the end of the day, the 10th step talks about, and to try to practice self-restraint and to try to persevere, which means simply to continue on taking my own inventory, to continue cleaning my side of the street, to continue my prayer and meditation. And, you know, step 11 says praying only for the knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. You know, a lot of times I go, God, show me Your will for me, blah, blah, blah. You know, I would forget the second part, Your power. You know, I don't have what it takes to stay sober, you know. And a lot of times I forget that, and I think it's up to me. And it's like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. No, I have to pray for the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And, you know, I tried it today also. You know, a friend of mine taught me, you know, invite God into your day in the morning. Ask Him to hang out with you. You know, let's go do the day together. You know, there's nothing that God can, or nothing anybody can, you know, give to me that me and God can't handle. You know, if I have that attitude, I can go out and face the world today, and I can do it successfully. You know, and our last step talks about love and service, the principle of love and service, and that's a good step. Service. I talked a lot about service. Love's a whole nother thing, and, you know, I was looking for love in all the wrong places, like a lot of us do. And, you know, I found such a deeper meaning to love, and I found it in these rooms. And, you know, since that, the marriage I had for 18 years dissolved in this program, and because of the power in, of this program, of program power, my husband and I, my ex and I are friends today. And I have a new man in my life, and he is incredibly awesome. I've been with him for 8 months. We've never had an unkind word. I prayed about it. I said, God, if You want me to be with someone, please send them to me. And I met a man from, he's from Vegas, and he's got over 10 years of sobriety, and he's awesome. He treats me like a queen, and it's what I always wanted. And my house is filled with love and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still work with others, and I still pray. I still attend meetings. And, you know, my hope is today, you know, I prayed before the meeting, and I said, God, you know, if You want me to carry a message tonight, please let me do so. It's none of my business anymore. You know, I have a new employer. I work for God. And I've found a really awesome God in this program. And over the years, you know, going through my divorce, losing a job, I bought a house, you know, with my divorce settlement. Then I found out I was losing my job. Then I lost my job, took a year off with my severance package. I got a new job, and I hate my new job, and so I got a new job. And I just got offered a new job yesterday, and it's going to be for a lot more money and closer to my house. And, you know, God is awesome. And you know, all the good things that happen in my life are because I believe of simply trying to practice the principles of this program a day at a time, not taking a drink pill or fix one day at a time, and trying to carry the message. So, again, if you're new, I'd really like to welcome you and encourage you to give yourself a break. And if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, this is the easier, softer way, for sure. And, you know, if you're hurting tonight and feeling like you want to go drink, please grab somebody and just share the secret, man. You know, it might save your life. And with that, that's all I have to say about that. Thanks for letting me share. God bless.